From UA Little Rock Public Radio, this is The Art Scene. I'm Daniel Breen. If you've never heard the name Florence Foster Jenkins, maybe this will ring a bell. Jenkins was an American socialite who rose to prominence as sort of an early 20th century cult figure in New York music circles. Though her style was unusual to say the least, Jenkins found numerous fans in celebrities of the music world, even performing at Carnegie Hall 75 years ago. She came back into the limelight when Meryl Streep portrayed her in the 2016 biopic simply titled Florence Foster Jenkins. Now, Opera in the Rock brings her life to the stage in the shape of a two-character play based on Jenkins' life, titled Souvenir, a Fantasia, on the life of Florence Foster Jenkins. Today, we'll speak with soprano Christine Donahue, who plays the titular role, about the one-night-only show being held at Arkansas Rep on November 2nd.
I arrived in Arkansas in the spring of 1984. I had been hired by the then opera company, Arkansas Opera Theater, to perform Micaela in Carmen. And there was a gentleman in the chorus to whom I barely spoke, who, when I arrived back the next season, we talked a little bit more. This is now my husband of 33 years. But it's what brought me to Arkansas Opera Theater, brought me to Arkansas. George Mayo, who was in the chorus, kept me here. And I was fortunate for about 20 years to sing something pretty much every season with that company. So it sort of cemented my career as an opera singer, I have to say. And I managed to be able to perform some roles more than once as a result. Sometimes in this business, you only, I won Micaela, one Traviata, whatever. And this is going the direction I wanted it to go. Anyway, so I had an opportunity to, you know, test my mettle on the stage every year, pretty much. Anyway, I've done a lot of singing in regional companies. I did have 2 years at New York City Opera. I've sung in Hong Kong, China, and up in Canada. And I presently am teaching voice and diction at the University of Central Arkansas. So that was sort of a surprise for me, but I've been doing it. This is my 20th year teaching over there, and I've been really happy with that.
When people have had a musical life like yourself, there's often sort of a catalyzing moment or something when you're young, some like a funny story that happens that, you know, your parents will tell to embarrass you that say, oh, this is why they're a singer now. Is there anything like
that?
Well,
I have to say that when I was five, I sang my first solo at the Tom Thumb wedding. I was raised in a little town in northeastern Pennsylvania, and all of the grade schools got together for a May Day program, and all the kindergartners were to participate in the Tom Thumb wedding. And I was chosen as soloist. So I remember standing in front of a microphone in the high school football stadium singing, I don't know, probably in front of thousands of people, Oh, Promise Me. And it, I remember it very distinctly, the woman complaining about the organ because someone had put a board up over the control pedals, and just standing there in front of this microphone in a sweet little voice. I read through the play, and it wasn't a matter of did I want to do it? I had to do it. So much of what Florence says about how she feels about music, there's one line, since I know that music, you know, my music will desert me, perhaps it would have been better not to have been so blessed, you know, to know that you're going to lose that. And just hoping that the music, she says things about wishing that the music would go on forever. And of course it can't. And so these were things that I'd been facing in my own life because I'm getting older. The voice isn't what it used to be. And anyway, it was just a matter of, oh my gosh, this, I have to say these things. I have to put these out there for the public because I feel these so very deeply. But yes, I'd heard about her in college. And like Cosme McMoon, her accompanist, says in the play, you know, people may not have known her, but they knew enough to laugh when you mentioned her name. And that's kind of the way we all responded to listening to her recordings. She sounds ridiculous. But in her mind, she sounded wonderful. And as she said, it's all about the music. It's the music you hear in your head. And, you know, she had a sexually transmitted disease that she got from her husband. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that tinnitus or tinnitus, however you want to pronounce it, can come along with that. And I'm wondering if it's not possible that she just had this ringing in her ears and really wasn't aware of what was coming out of her mouth. It's a different effect when you're singing. And Cosme has some wonderful lines about that, too. He said, you're kind of like a prize fighter, only you're using your voice and you can't always tell what's coming out. So I have a feeling that that might have been part of it. But she just threw herself into the music. She had an incredible love and passion for it. And it was her friends who commented on the depth of her feeling that brought about her first concerts. And she didn't need the money. Her father had died and left her and her mother quite a bit of money. So she gave the money to charity, and it was all for fun. But at the very, very last part of her life, she had an opportunity to sing at Carnegie Hall, and she packed the place. 2,000 seats sold out within a day, and there was a waiting list of 2,000 people who wanted to come. So there was she'd garnered quite a reputation for herself.
She's kind of, in recent years come back to the forefront, but at the time, based on what you said at Carnegie Hall, it seems like people realized what she actually was. She wasn't just sort of like this novelty or something.
Well, I think they saw her as a novelty. Did she see herself as a novelty? I've never been able to figure that out. Did she know what she sounded like? Was she, I don't know, was she using it as a way to get popularity or notoriety? I don't know. I honestly think not. I think that she was all in it for the music, for the sheer joy of expressing herself through the music. I honestly think that's what it was. I feel, you're talking about the movie that came out, I think, a couple of years ago with Meryl Streep. It's just called Florence Foster Jenkins. That kind of brought her back into the public limelight. I think in the movie, and I was really pleased by this, and also especially in the play, that she comes off as being really quite charming and guileless. She is sweet and honest and true in the way she approaches the music. And I don't think she was ever manipulative in any way. She just naively came out and did what she knew how to do. On YouTube, you can find some other people doing this play. And sometimes they just go crazy wild and screeching. And she didn't sing like that. And again, I'm going to say that I thought Meryl Streep did a really fine job in kind of mimicking and imitating her singing. I'd like to think that I do something similar to that. The one question I get all the time, how that must be so hard singing off tune. And it's not. It really is not. The hard thing is singing in tune. And so I do kind of sometimes just let whatever come out, getting close to the pitch. But it's fun to manipulate that, to know that, okay, here I am centered really, really well on this pitch. Next one, just a hair down. That's fun. It's not difficult at all.
Well, that was, I think, one thing Meryl Streep said about it. It was sort of like she could act with reckless abandon. Like it was, yeah. It was this freedom that she was given all of a sudden. You must feel that even more as, a professional singer, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I do. It's like, oh, thank heavens, I don't have to worry about that B flat because she never hit it properly. So I don't have to hit it properly.
Well, yeah, it sort of opens up this whole question of whether the act of creating something, is it the act itself that is sort of like this religious experience that makes you feel good, or is it the product that you put out? Because for her, it seems like it was the act.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Daniel. Well, for her, it may have been the act. You know, it's so funny. In my career as an opera singer, I loved the process. I loved working on the music. I loved the rehearsals. I loved the staging. I loved talking about the motivation and the characters and, why we're doing something in a certain way. That for me was it. The performance for me was always a letdown. I hate to say that, but it truly was. Because you may not hit that same spark that you hit in a rehearsal one day, or when you were, I'm thinking of some other rehearsals. One time I was in a rehearsal for Tales of Hoffman. I was singing the Dolls aria. I stood up, and it was a Sitzprobe, so it's just orchestra and the singers in a room, no staging. I honestly don't know where the singing came from. It was like an out-of-body experience. The conductor noticed it. I definitely felt it. I never accomplished that ever again, certainly not on stage, because there are too many other things to deal with. But at that moment in time, it was like, oh my gosh, who's singing this? Because it didn't feel like I was making any effort at all. It just was pouring out of me. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, those things don't happen at the key moments. You know, they usually happen in a rehearsal. So I don't know. I think you might be right about Florence, though. I think she probably always felt it in the performance as well. But as Cosme says, she loved to rehearse. So she might have felt much the same thing, that the rehearsal process was, you know, for some of us, the key thing.
When you were talking earlier, that brought up another thing. Was it hard to sort of get that mid-Atlantic accent? Or...
Oh, okay. So I'm from Pennsylvania, but I don't really speak like the people in Pennsylvania. And I'm not sure that the people that I grew up with spoke that way back in the 30s and 40s.
Sure, you know? Yeah, it's sort of like an affected...
It kind of is. You remember, You know, you've watched movies from the 30s and 40s, and they have this, you know, sort of... I don't even know how to talk about it, but it is a put-on way of speaking. I'll tell you who influenced my voice for her was Meryl Streep as Julia Child.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Because she flips back and forth, you know, between this head voice and chest voice thing all the time. And I have a feeling that that's more the way Florence would have spoken, in sort of a put-on way, because back in the 30s and 40s, that's what they did.
You mentioned the question that you get most often, is it hard to sing badly, essentially? Is it hard to protect your voice when you're doing that? You mentioned that, you know, some people really go for the gusto and screech and things like that.
Right.
But, you know, she's not doing anything too wild, but is it still, do you need to take any precautions?
It's tiring. It's a 2-hour play. I'm not the accompanist. Cosme McMoon is on stage the entire time. I come on and off, so I have a little bit more of a break, but I will say that the speaking is probably what gets to me more than anything. Some of the singing, the hardest part is coming out at the very end and trying to sing beautifully. That is hard. So I hope everyone will be very kind when that happens. But that's the hardest part, because you've been talking for most of 2 hours, mm-hmm. and then you come out at the end and have to sing, you know, the best way you possibly can.
So it's because you've been talking rather than just singing out of tune?
I think it's the talking more than the singing out of tune. Mm-hmm. But probably combination of both.
That's fascinating. I did want to ask about her accompanist. What was sort of their relationship?
Cosme McMoon was, he sort of explains his setup in New York. He was like a lot of young musicians who were in the city playing for lessons, when he starts out, he's playing in a club in New York, and this is all kind of done in flashback. So just trying to pick up work wherever you can. You can play for ballet classes and all that kind of stuff. And a friend of his mentioned that he had an aunt who sang some and needed an accompanist. So he goes over to her hotel at the Ritz and meets her. And she decides that he's the ticket. He's the one that she wants to play for her. And at first he's a little embarrassed by the whole thing and thinking that he can pull away from it. But by the end of the play, what I love is he says, you know, I listened to other singers and something was missing, that they just didn't have what she had when she did the singing. So he sees the good in her, loves her enthusiasm. She's never down about anything. She's always very hopeful. And he said it kind of rubs off on you after a while, you know? And I think their relationship, it's more a development of their relationship, this play is, so that you see how much she means to him by the end. And that's a very poignant moment, actually, when he expresses that. Mm-hmm. So,
And the play is from his perspective.
The play is basically from his perspective, yeah.
And he's like flashing back to
that.
Okay.
First time we meet, when they decide she gets an opportunity to sing at town hall, he talks her out of it. She's going to do a recording. Oh my gosh, I've been asked to sing at Carnegie Hall. That's another scene. And then the last bit of it is when they actually do the performance at Carnegie Hall. So you just hear little snippets of arias. There's no aria that you're ever going to hear all the way through. You just hear snippets and bits and pieces of music from me. Cosme has wonderful pieces to sing. Oh my gosh, beautiful old ballads from the 30s and 40s. One of my favorites is Violets for Her Fur. I had never heard that song before, and he gets to sing the whole thing through. Tim is a wonderful pianist, but he's also a fabulous singer and wonderful on stage. He really is a triple threat, and he just does a brilliant job in the part of Cosme McMoon. He was, I think, born to do it as well. And I feel I was born to do Florence, so.
That was soprano Christine Donahue talking about her role in Opera in the Rock's upcoming staging of Souvenir, a fantasia on the life of Florence Foster Jenkins. The show is Saturday, November 2nd at 7:30 at Arkansas Rep. California-based sculptor Chooks makes hauntingly stunning human forms radiate color in an unlikely way. A selection of some of Chooks' clay and mixed media works are showing at Hearn Fine Art in Little Rock right now as part of the exhibit Ubuntu, I Am Because We Are. The exhibit runs until November 2nd. The art scene caught up with Chooks at his home near Los Angeles.
I was raised in San Jose, California, and that's basically where my creative inspiration started. And as a result of watching my mother at a very young age, I watched her sew, and she would make my brothers and I clothes. And I remember one day I was sitting next to her while she was sewing, and she started drawing, and I asked her, I said, "What is this?" And she says, "Oh, I'm drawing you and your brother's clothes." And she was making herself a dress, and I had never seen a drawing before. And I just remember shortly after that asking her for pencil and paper, and I started, took it in my room, the pencil and paper in my room, and I started drawing.
It seems like you were saying with your mom, who was making clothes, you know, it seems like you've moved toward a more functional medium where you're actually, you know, creating things with your hands.
Well, you know, the drawings, I realized much later that she was making sculpture because she had to put the clothes together and we could wear them so they became tactile. They went from a two-dimensional surface on a drawing to a three-dimensional form that you could now wear. So, I mean, that was amazing in itself that a drawing could turn itself into, it could become something tactile. You know, you could wear it, pick it up, and, you know, hold it. You know, it had a dimensionality to it. So, I mean, it took me years to realize that, but just the significance of understanding that I was around the age of 5 or 6 years old when I started drawing. And then, you know, it just expanded into, you know, taking the paper and getting introduced to clay, which is something I got introduced to when I was in the fifth grade. One of my teachers at the time says, "Hey, we're going to work with clay." And I didn't know what clay was again. And he says, "I'm going to show you how to make a bowl." And then, so he took the clay out. He said, "You make a bowl and then you can make a cup or whatever you're going to make with it." So I asked him, I made the bowl and that wasn't enough for me. And so I said, "Can I have some more?" And I put another bowl on top of the other one. And then I started making a face. And it was just inherent. I knew exactly what to do with the clay. It just like, it's like, you know, I touched it, but I knew exactly at that young age. I was 11 years old. I knew exactly what to do with it. And so I started making this face. And it didn't register to me as anything. You know, it just says, okay, inherently I know what to do with this. So I did it. But when my teacher saw what I had made, he he was like, he had this kind of astonished look on his face, and he took what I did and paraded it around the entire school. And that made me feel really good. And it wasn't about me in general, it was about what I created.
Part of your process when you're making sculpture is that, like you were saying, when you're creating a 2D drawing into a 3D image, or do you just attack the block of clay directly and see what happens?
Yeah, now I don't draw. I just, if I have an idea, I'll draw it down. I'll do a short sketch on whatever piece of paper I'll see, so I can remember what it was that I think I want to create. But as far as drawing the images that I create now, I just, you know, I draw with the clay. I just get the bag of clay, the image is in my head, it's locked in, and then I just go.
Yeah, that must be sort of a, I'm not sure of the exact word, but almost sort of like a religious experience when you're just, it's just you and you're communing with this sort of raw material that eventually becomes so human, I guess you could say.
It is a very spiritual, it is very spiritual, because not only am I creating, I am in contact with my inner senses, and I think I'm in contact with them at the highest level, because what I'm creating, I want to create at the highest level that I can as a human being. So you have to tap into other energies that are around you and be aware of those, and then take those energies and put it into what you are creating. So for me, in that instance, it is very spiritual.
I think the one thing that definitely stands out, at least to me, is your use of color, or sometimes your choice to not use color. I don't want to draw like a false equivalency or anything, but is that sort of like the aura of the piece, would you say, or just whatever color you're feeling when you're making the piece?
Well, color for me has been somewhat of a challenge, because I predominantly work with clay. And so there's a difference between when you work with clay, because people say you work with clay, the first thing they ask you, well, what kind of pots do you make? And I said, well, you know, I'm like, well, I don't throw on the wheel. That's not what I do. And then they say, well, you're a ceramicist. And I'm like, well, I am a ceramicist in a sense, but I'm a ceramicist who sculpts in clay. So the natural progression for most ceramicists are when they fire their piece of clay, then the next thing is to figure out what color you're going to use, and then they immediately go to glazes or oxides. Well, I've never liked glazes or oxides, because I've seen when you put a glaze on a piece of pottery, that most of the time, depending on the thickness of the glaze, it takes the detail away. And if you notice, my work is very detailed. And I want those details to show in the work. So I had to find a color process that would enhance the work, highlight certain features, but wouldn't take the detail away from it.
I think I read somewhere that it's a secret process that you use. So how long did that take for you to develop that specific process?
It's still evolving, because, you know, I started introducing, I don't mind saying this, motor oil, and I had some transmission fluid laying around, and I said, let me put a little bit of this in here, and you know, so I'm kind of like the mad scientist when it comes to color, you know, I use whatever's, you know, in my environment. I'm always testing and working on different colors to you know, just to challenge my mind and see, you know, how they're going to react to what it is I'm creating.
Well, yeah, I think that's very interesting what you were saying about the process of you finding your own style of making sculpture, especially in how other people react to it, especially other, you know, ceramicists and people who worked in clay. I was just wondering, when you were, you know, first starting out, was your work well received, or were gallery owners or other artists sort of taken aback, or just kind of wondering what you were doing?
Well, it took me a while to establish myself as an artist, because first of all, you know, I was so young when I started out, and I think a lot of the galleries and places I went to that were connected to art, they, you know, trying to see if I was serious and how serious I was, but I was dead serious. Secondly, while I was in school, I kept having my work destroyed. It was, you know, they put it in the kiln and it would come back broke, this, that, and the other. And I mean, it was all kinds of weird stuff that would happen to it. So I just decided that I wasn't going to fire my work. So I would create my work and I developed a burnishing style that made the work look like, you know, it was very shiny and very polished. But when I would take it to galleries, they would say, they would, you know, they would really like the work, but then they say, well, what kind of ceramic is it? Or is this marble, or is it a bronze? I said, no, it's clay. And I'm like, is it fired? And I'm like, no. And so once I told them it wasn't fired, they, you know, they kind of backed away because it was very brittle. But I still have work to this day that I created almost, you know, more than 30 years ago that is just as pristine as it was the day I created. And what I wanted to do with that process was to have whoever purchased the work develop a relationship with the clay. So once you purchased it, you found the place to put it. And you couldn't just go up and touch it and feel on it and move it around. You had to keep it in that particular place and understand the properties of it and just enjoy it for what it was at that particular time. And once I told people, this is how you deal with this, then they would do that. And so it became very personal, and it made the, you know, the work a lot more precious as well, because they had a deeper respect for it, because they knew they couldn't just manhandle the work and take it and move it around in any place, because they knew it would break. And they understood that. So I thought that was a great point for me to understand the properties of clay. I do fire my clay now, but I still, you know, I have some pieces out there that I just haven't fired. So it was just developing and understanding a relationship with the clay and with my materials, which I felt is very important to do as an artist.
Yes, and that's definitely evident in your works. You know, you definitely focus on the human form, especially the head and the face. I'm just wondering if that... that's a result of the material that you work with, and then are these sort of faces that you see every day, or people you may know, or just people that you might have known in a past life or something? I'm just wondering where the direct inspiration for them comes from.
Well, that's a great question, because I don't use any models, or I just don't. I mean, I just think it would drive me crazy to just continue to sit and look at some person and then try to recreate them. I'm like, well, you want to do that, go look at yourself in the mirror or take a picture of yourself. For me, when I create a face, I can give it what I want it to have. I give it its own personality. I make it aesthetically pleasing for me. That's the first thing I want to do. I'm not trying to please anyone. I'm trying to please myself. And so during that process, I'm having this conversation with my clay, and it's just a beautiful conversation, and it's just, you know, it's very joyous, and there's no, you know, I have no schematics to follow. I mean, I'm just following my own intuition, so it's a freedom. It just, you know, it just makes it a lot easier for me. The creative process for me is not a visual process. It's an emotion. So even if I'm looking at someone, I want to feel their emotion. I'm not really concerned what they look like. Of course, I probably can render them as far as what they look like. But to me, it's how do you feel? What energy are you giving me, and what energy am I getting you? And how can I transpose that into something creative? So that's the beauty I feel in the creative process. And for me, I mean, I think you get so much more out of it when you can let go and just be free like that, and then create that put that energy into what you're doing. And I think when I do that for people, they appreciate that much more. They're not even concerned about what I look like or what they look like. You know, they're just like, you captured my energy, and that's what I want.
That was Chooks, whose sculptures can be seen at Hearn Fine Art in the exhibit Ubuntu, I Am Because We Are, running through November 2nd.
And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.